Hi everyone, my name is Wayne. I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to reiterate what Mike was saying. It's been a pleasure to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's changed my life immensely. It's been my privilege to serve with some people in this room in Alcoholics Anonymous, the fellowship and my home group. I also belong to group 3, and I've really been touched by the hospitality and the committee and Jan's hospitality to stay up there, and it's been just great. I guess for speaking, I'd like to take you guys on a little ride through my life, I guess, and you might be able to draw lines like what it was like, what happened, how it's like I won't have to announce that, I don't think. although in some areas of my life I'm still waiting for how it's like, but I started out like most normal people as a kid, and I started doing life and the way most kids do life, and somewhere along the line in pretty much middle childhood, early childhood, I found that if I had done something wrong, I got the attention of my parents, and I'm not sure if they didn't give me enough attention when I didn't do something wrong, but when I did something wrong, they really came at me, and it made me feel loved. They really did care, because I could tell. I'm not sure what they cared about, but I was hoping it was me, and that kind of set up a pattern for me to get in trouble. And so I was the guy that got in trouble. I was the kid that most other kids couldn't play with. They were on restriction. You can get on restriction when you can't leave your house, and then the next stage would be getting on restriction where you can't play with Wayne. And I kind of liked that. That's kind of cool. And the weird warp sick respect that I got from that kind of negative stuff was something that I carried in my life and drug me down some very painful, lonely spots. And they say in the book that, we drank because we like the effect caused by alcoholism, and I agree with that. And I guess each individual, not only do they have an individual recovery from alcoholism or an individual way that they live life without drinking, they probably have an individual effect that they either cherished or attached themselves to when they drank. And mine was to not feel. I'm not a real touchy-feeling guy. I'm not going to throw teddy bears out for everyone, but it was weird to have feelings. And so I quickly became involved with groups of people that got in trouble, and at the age of 16, 17, we smoked cigarettes, we got in fights, we wore Levi jackets, we drank. And I was in Southern California, is the same as up here. I think you're supposed to be 21 to drink, and I don't think you're supposed to drink in public, and I was already doing that at 14, 15, and other things too. I can remember probably even earlier than that, in the seventh grade, I did something real weird. I forget what it was, but I had to go to juvenile hall, and I remember when I got back from juvenile hall, and I was walking down, through the schoolyard, I could see people kind of not necessarily radically stepping back to let me walk by, but giving me that look like we really don't want to know you. And I like that feeling too. And it was a real neat feeling. I thought, and somewhere I decided that I could label this general fake Wayne as cool. And I if there's any drawback besides an education to contented sobriety, it would be being cool. And I fought that coolness through 8 or 9 treatment centers, 3 different prisons, juvenile halls, YAs. No one could tell me anything because I was a cool guy. I have to have the answer. If it's not my answer, if you don't agree with me, then you're wrong. And that's just kind of how I operated. Anyway, so like as I got in more trouble and as the parents kept crying, and you know, which proved that they loved me, I just continued on. Like it was, there was no reason to turn back. This was a great lifestyle. You know, I got a little bit better at fighting, and people would ask me to be in their corner if they had a little spat, and I'd be in their corner, and I brought big friends, and, you know, I was the guy to know. And we drank, and that was part of the game, you know, we drank. And, you know, I started getting, when I turned 18, I had a little bit of trouble with the law, which I'd already been in and out of trouble with the law a lot, but this is a grand jury format, and they got me for 2 counts, possession, transportation, and sales of dangerous drugs, and this is back in 1971. They didn't like my kind of people in the courtroom, and it was pretty hard, but it was a pretty cool thing. I had a grand jury indictment. I mean, you can go show that to people, say, yeah, this is a grand... This, do you got a grand jury indictment? Well, I know you don't, but I do. And if you're not familiar with that level of law enforcement, and you got to remember, I was a dope dealer. I was an alcoholic and a dope dealer, not an addict. All the evidence went to the court, and a group of people said he's guilty. And then they put out this thing called a warrant. And I just got married. I just had a little baby boy. And I just got sentenced to 2 to 10 years in state penitentiary. And a lot of people would probably, that would be very painful for most people. And it was for me too, but I don't think I was allowed to feel the pain. I needed to reach somewhere and not feel this. And alcohol had been always my scapegoat. It was a really neat thing. They might as well just change the label from Bacardi to don't have to feel, you know. And I could drink, don't have to feel, and it was cool. And anyway, so I remember, you know, weird things in my memory, like my mom holding up the Christmas presents under the tree and a little snapshot photo through the glass at the county jail while I was fighting my appeal. And hard, miserable, poor old me, woe stuff that just hurt. And so I got out eventually about a year on an appeal, and I beat the things back to an alternate felony. And I got out, and I was on probation for 3 years. And I put together some money, and I went to my probation officer, and I said, you know, I need to leave the state of California. And my probation officer said, that's probably a good idea. And in AA, they call that a geographic, but back then it was interstate to avoid prosecution, interstate. And I paid this guy a couple, like a $1,500 back then, which was, and he gave me no receipt. And what he did for me is he recommended an out-of-state release on my own reconnaissance. So I was released from parole. I moved to Oregon. I got into school. I drank. Up there in Oregon, they drink pretty good. There's pretty good drinkers actually everywhere. You just got to find them. And I got so good at finding these kind of people, I could drive by and sense one. You know? That yard's not mowed, you know? Oh, shit, that's my sponsor. No. But, you know, and I gravitated towards that. It says in the book we gravitate towards people, you know, and we seek lower companions. And I'm not sure why. I guess, you know, if we always had somebody to look down on, we always felt one up and like I'm not as bad as Joe, you know, or whatever. And you know, if I ever get as bad as Joe, I'll quit drinking, you know. And I remember when people all around me were dying, you know, and I'd find somebody else that wasn't dead yet and go, if I ever get as bad as him, I'll quit. And anyway, through my long early childhood of getting in and out of trouble, I found this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wasn't the guy that pulled up to Alcoholics Anonymous and ate a donut, drank a cup of coffee, and been sober ever since. That's just not my story. A lot of the reason is because when I went to AA meetings, I was usually drunk. Some of them, they were so boring, I just drank out back until I heard the Lord's Prayer. And I'd come in and, you know, there'd be a little old lady with a basket, and I'd, you know, walk up with a flex, and I'd put my court card in there, and she'd look at me, and she'd say, keep coming back, and I'd go, just sign the thing, and she'd sign it, and I'd bring it in, turn it into whoever. I'd get one or two signatures from the membership here, and then forge the rest. You know, I was a regular alcoholic, you know, and AA didn't work, and you know, I'm pretty sure I know why it didn't work. But I'm not sure why I didn't want to stop drinking. You know, I've heard around the rooms, I've heard a lot of places that, you know, if you have a desire to stop drinking, you can stop drinking. You know, if you really want to quit, you can't need to quit. The old lady can't want you to quit. The judge can't order you to quit. You know, you have to want to. And I didn't want that. I think I wanted to want. That was about as close as I could get, you know. I mean, I hear people who pray for the willingness to be willing, and I wasn't there. I was really having it. Alcohol was serving purposes in my life, which was like the not feeling thing, the weird street respect thing, the head thing. It was feeding this, and I didn't want to quit. You know, I started drinking and doing other things to where I was almost dead a few times. And I'd go into these treatment centers, and, you know, they would. I went into one treatment center. I remember, I think, my normal weight, if I ever had a normal weight, was like 160 pounds. I went into this place at 110 pounds. It was a 30-day treatment center. And the first 10 days, I was unconscious. On IVs, and when I got out of the detox little period, they gave me a big book, which I'm street clothes, and I went into the other part of the treatment center there and learned how to be assertive, and did some basket weaving and lifted a few weights, and you know, I gained my weight back, and I think I put 30 days sober in the 30-day hospital. That was pretty easy. It's pretty easy to get 30 days when you're locked down in a 30-day treatment center. It's day one. And, you know, I don't know when you start thinking about day one outside the hospital, but for me, I started thinking about it right around the 20th day I was in there. And I'm not going to drink. I'm not going to drink. I'm not going to drink. And as soon as you get out, where's the nearest bar? I mean, I don't know how it happens. You know, it just happens. Your thinking just goes from one swing to the other. That easy. I can't explain how it happens. I don't know how it happens. I don't know how to stop it from happening. But that's what happened. And then you start going to these AA meetings. People would come in, the H&I thing, and they'd tell you, you know, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, and I'd look at these people and go, man, you know, I don't think I want what they have, you know, don't want it. Can you imagine not drinking for the rest of your life? No, don't want it. Just give me my weight back, roll back the fog where I can put together a couple sentences, and I'm on a roll. I'm back out there. You know, we'll go. I can remember having people from the treatment center come into my detox area, and I'd be on an IV pole, like one eye open, and they would be looking at me and you know, like just going, oh my God, are you going to make it? And I guess they didn't know if I was going to make it. I'm an alcoholic. I'll make it through anything. But they didn't think I was going to make it. And, you know, I remember telling somebody, you know, like I'd get out of that detox, and I'd go back into the regular recovery half of this thing, and you know, they would say, you know, I'd ask them, I said, what were you guys coming through my room for with the counselors? And they said, well, they were telling us that if we kept drinking, we would end up like you. And with all the, I have this thing that I've earmarked alcoholic contempt, and I'd say, man, that they don't know what they're talking about here. I got 4 or 5 recoveries left, and I was so close to being dead. I mean, you could see my muscle fiber through my skin. My eyes were sunk back in my head. I was underweight. If you saw me, you would. If I wasn't moving, you'd probably think I was dead. And I put my parents through that. I put my family through that. I put my friends. Most alcoholics can get rid of people that love them. We have a little knack of not acting out in front of the people that love us because they might actually slow our drinking down. And so, you know, as my bottoms appeared lower and lower on the scale from, you know, from homeless to street person to whatever, I began to, like, you know, my best friend on the street, whatever his name is, I've known for a week, you know, and that's it. The people that grew up in football and Cub Scouts and all that, you know, normal junk, they're working jobs with children, and I never did get a job. And I'm not sure, I don't think I was lazy. Most alcoholics aren't lazy. I just couldn't hold a job. It wasn't so much working, getting up and working, you know, at 8 o'clock in the morning. It was like, you know, the work day was fine. It was putting together more than 2 or 3 in a row that held me back from getting, you know, keeping jobs. And there's a thing they call sabotaging, and you know, I would do something. I'd work my job and do my thing, and you know, get a driving under the influence, or run up a big debt, or get in a crash, or spend the rent money. I mean, I would always do something. There was always something really neat to just, like, prove to myself that I was a total idiot and I ought to drink, you know. And it was quite a pattern. Most people were probably caught on to that pattern, or had somebody that could help them catch on to that pattern. And like I said, I don't know what happens to people. I don't know why it happens to people, and they come to AA and they get sober, and you know, life turns to roses. You know, that wasn't my experience. I can remember getting in more and more trouble, and I got to be pretty much a not a connoisseur, but almost a that's a good enough word, a connoisseur on recovery treatment centers. You know, I could walk in and check out the credentials, you know, the therapist, the psych, you know, check out, yeah, this is a pretty high class, but what's the food like? You know, and I've been in and out of those equal amount of times with jail. You know, the same thing, you go in jail, you find out who the toughest dudes in the whole place are, you get right next to them, and hi, you're my friend, you know, and anybody's got a problem with me, they got it with us now, and that's kind of what I did in the treatment centers, that hip, cool, slick thing, I would get in and start doing treatment. And, you know, I started to learn how to do treatment pretty well, too. I was pretty much an expert now on getting, like, 60, 90 days. And, you know, I could tell you what happens. I talked about the fog rolling back, and that happens. You gain your weight back. I'm not sure about the self-respect and all the emotional baggage and wreckage and all the, I don't know about any of that. All I know is that, you know, you feel better. You take alcohol away from an alcoholic, he feels really bad for a while, and then he starts to feel good. And you know, if you stay in AA long enough, you'll get a couple sober friends, and you'll listen to the meetings, and you'll get like a sober job, you know, painter's helper, you know, an alcoholic type job, you know, except for you don't drink, you know. And I wreckage of the past keep coming. Mike, the previous speaker and good friend in AA, was talking about how, you know, when you stand still in recovery and the wreckage of your past comes forward. I heard it explained it was like kind of being in a station wagon, and when you're drinking beers, you throw the beer can over your shoulder in the back, you know, and you just, like, all this garbage is piled up. And when you get to AA, it's like jamming on the brakes, and all this stuff rushes forward, and you go, oh, I remember that, I remember that. And these are the things you don't want to remember. These are the things that you drank. So I'm inventories are a real good thing. And hopefully it's plain to see for all of us here that's why we do that kind of stuff. It's because we don't want stuff hidden inside that we don't want to feel. We want to be able to say, you know what, I feel fine. I haven't lied to anybody. I don't have to worry about anybody. Nobody owes me money. I don't owe any money. You know, I mean, those kind of good feelings are way more fun than the bad ones. You know, and as I develop my slippery little path in like short-term recovery, I met some really neat people in AA. And you know, what would the common denominator here, I think, is that there's love. You know, there's love and understanding. And you know, there's not many places you can find that. Yeah, there's something that's unwritten. I'm not sure it's in the book. You know, it's an understanding we have for each other, and like a feeling. You know, I mean, there's people in AA I don't like, but I love them. You know, I love them for being in here and not drinking and trying not to create wreckage. You know, well, I can remember now that I'm starting to run like these self-analysis. See, I was actually doing inventories before I even got to AA, I'm, you know, like, I'd sit down and, you know, I would, like, look over my life. That's kind of like a four-step, you know, and the best way to do it for me was to drink, like, rum and coke, you know. I would drink rum and coke and look back over my life, and I'd go, boy, I made some really bad decisions, you know, and if I just didn't hang around with Gary, I don't think you know, I would have had to do this, or if I just didn't hang around with these guys, you know, I wouldn't be in all this trouble. And trouble likes trouble, and that's, you know, that was just, that's my story. I mean, I was there in trouble. You don't have to come from stuff like that to be an alcoholic. That's just, I did. And you know, I had a baby in 1971. We moved to Oregon, and she ran with the son, and now I have this built-in pain. Built-in pain's good, because you can put it in a bag, you can keep it zipped up. Anytime you need this pain, you just unzip it, and you feel the pain. And, like, if, you know, we don't talk about dope here, but if we were, most people guard their dope real close, put it in a drawer, hide it under the rug, you know what I mean, and they know it, and they don't run out. If they get close to running out, they go buy more. You know what I mean? They really, really love, or act like they really are attached or love that dope. And that's how I was with pain, because I needed that pain. I don't know why. I'm not recovered yet, but I figured out through this rum and coke inventory that I needed pain. It's something that somehow each one of these things causes pain. Well, why do I drink? So I don't have to feel the pain. Oh, okay, so I already have a definition for an alcoholic. Someone who drinks because of problems caused by alcohol. That's easy. It's a cycle. It's going down. It's like the Titanic going down. And I can remember going down. I can remember getting out of a jail or a treatment center, which is like, you're up, you're healthy, and then bottoming out. That's a word I learned here in AA. When you bottom out, it's different than winning the lottery. Not much. But like the time period between getting out and bottoming out for a while was like 6 months. I mean, I could stay up, pay maybe 1 month rent, get thrown out, move into a friend's couch, get thrown out, live in my car. And I could make it like 6 months before I was back behind bars trying to figure out what happened. And then the periods of time get shorter. It's going, okay, now you can only stay out for like 3 months. You know, now it's only 2 months. I remember one time I got out of jail, and something they used my corduroy pants was very important evidence, and they needed to, the brown corduroy pants were like very important to the prosecution's case, and so they bagged them up for evidence. And so when they let me out of jail, I didn't have any clothes, so they gave me white paper coveralls and this plastic, have you guys ever been to jail? This plastic bag with your wallet, your belt, your keys, all that stuff. And I got out of jail with my paper coveralls on and my plastic bag full of my private stuff, and I had enough money for some beer, so I went to the 7-Eleven, which is right by the county jail I got out of, and I was out back drinking, you know, Heineken darts, because I was a cool drunk, and Police officer pulled up. I'm standing in my white paper coveralls holding my property, drinking Heineken's. And I said, what's happening? Just get in. And so that, I bottomed out real quick on that one, you know. And I thought all those were bottoms. You know, I'm here to tell you they weren't. Those weren't bottoms. Bottoms are like really weird. And I started, you know, I used to think I was pretty good at recovery, and now I think I'm pretty good at bottoms. I mean, I know how to do a bottom, you know. Being homeless is a full-time job. If you ever, it builds character too. I don't suggest you guys go out and try to be homeless for a month or two just to see what it's like, but it's hard. And if you want to pick a real hard place, go to San Francisco, where you got to like stand in line to be homeless. They got so many homeless people that have come before you. You can't get that homeless status yet. You got to kind of wait for seniority to build up. You know, I remember waiting in the missions for like a sandwich or whatever the heck, and you got to get the sandwich quick. First 100 people, go over here and get a room voucher, and they'll probably give you a schedule for AA, I don't know, and then shoot over and get fed and get a free shower on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And I remember people sleeping on the cement that like passed out on alcohol, and their faces were frozen to the sidewalks. You know, and that's why you have cardboard. You got to have cardboard. You need to learn these things if you ever want to bottom out. And, you know, so bring cardboard with you. And have an AA schedule just in case things get real bad. And, you know, that's kind of my life. And I really okey-doke this program. And you know what? It's okay to do that, you know. People of long-term sobriety say that was okay. You know, they also said other stuff, too. I didn't want to hear, like, you know, you need to get sober sooner or later. You might as well do it while you're alive. And I said, you know, that guy's smart, you know. How much time do you got, you know? How many people are you sponsoring with that wisdom? And those guys that got those one-liners, you know, they love you, man. And then when things get tough, you get next to them because they'll show you how to do it without drinking. And, you know, that was my experience, too. I got some real good sponsorship in this program, and it wasn't until I became willing, you know, to do what you're supposed to do. And, you know, I can remember I had got put together like more than 90 days. It was like a breakthrough. You know, people have like, if I don't know if you've ever been in therapy, but they call them walls. You know, you get to a certain point and then you just like quit therapy because you don't want to go past this wall. But there's like walls in recovery too. And a 90-day was a wall for me. You know, I mean, I didn't even talk to people that had 93 days. If you had 88, me and you could relate, you know. But it was hard to get 90 days. Something would happen. Somebody would invite me somewhere. I'd be gone. And I remember breaking through the 90-day thing, and, you know, oh, yeah, 90 days is a hard one, man. The next one's a year. You know, I was in a treatment center again. Somehow I keep going to these places, man. They had free big books, probably why. They're not actually free. The one hospital was $40,000 for the big book. And I had to, but I got phone numbers, you know, and they were very valuable phone numbers. And those were people in AA. By the time when I came in with one day in the treatment center, I was getting phone numbers with people that were getting out that had 30 days. And then, like, when I had 10 days, the people had, like, 20 days. I'd known them for 10, and they're leaving. And it was like a whole generation. People were coming in behind getting my number. And that's kind of how AA works. You know, as somebody's holding on to one hand, they reach back to the other. And it's a real simple stuff that I didn't want to hear, feel, or know, or repeat. You know, I'm in this for sobriety. Oh, sobriety? You got sobriety? It was just like me waiting in line in jail for T-shirts. You know, if you have sobriety, I want two. You know, I want two for me. That's it. You know, if it's good for you, I want two. You know, and it's a taking. I'm taking. I'm still taking. And, you know, I had, when I came, that terrible coolness, the terrible uniqueness and stuff, and everybody has their own variety of it. Mine was very outspoken. And I was, I forget what I was. I was just a normal guy. I remember sitting in, they had Southern California, they have a thing called a participation meetings where, like, you don't even go to one if you don't want to speak. You read the schedule, it says participation. I didn't know you're supposed to participate. That was for long-term recovery. You know, I just read the thing and went, and I sat in this thing. These people were talking similar to the meeting we had in Jan's living room or last night. And you just go around the room. And, you know, they were going around the room. And when they got around to me, everybody's looking at me because it was my turn. And I said, you people are very sick. I understand that. I'm glad that getting it out in the open with the other people seems to work for you. But I'm not telling you guys nothing. And I don't know where I learned that behavior, but it somehow it saved my life a few years ago, and I got like a year's worth of recovery. And there was a couple minor glitches in the thing. There's like this ninth step thing. And they shouldn't put that ninth step in there so early because you can get in major league trouble, man. They have these things. Superior Court, Municipal Court, and I had warrants in like four or five different courthouses. My last run came all the way up through from Southern California on, and I had felony warrants in Orange County, and I had misdemeanor warrants in San Leandro, San Francisco, and a couple other places. So at that, when you get pushed that hard, it's time to recover again, and so I went into this treatment center, and I can remember going in front of one of those little judge guys with a robe, and I had a Just Say No hat on, big book under my arm. And I go, Your Honor, I found recovery. And he goes, What? And I go, Yeah, I'm in a treatment center now, and I've put together almost 30 days, and I think I have a real shot at changing my life, and I would really appreciate it if you would honor me with that opportunity and not lock me up. And he goes, looked at the DA. The DA looked back at him. They gave the old DA judge nod. It's a secret thing they learn in school. And they said, okay, dismissed. I go, right on. And I was sober. And I was driving back to group three happy. I had three other courthouses to go to. But hey, you know, one court at a time, isn't that what they say around here? The felony ones, I knew they weren't going to, they have like a thing called a joint suspended sentence. I can see none of you guys are getting trouble up here. When they'll sentence you to like 2 years in prison, but then they'll make you do like 9 months in county jail. And what they call that is they suspend the joint sentence, and they give you the 9 months, and you get in trouble again, and they give you the joint. And so the joint's this like camp stupid place down in Southern California, and I got to go there, and they have AA meetings in there, and I knew that I was not going to be able to walk in with a Just Say No hat. I was going to try it, but I had a real good feeling that I was absconding from probation, and I knew the warrants were out, it was cat and mouse, you know, and it was hard to live recovery without making an amends. And in my particular case, there's some things you can't do when you know that if you go down to the store for a dozen eggs, you might not be back for 3 years. And, you know, and so you don't want to borrow anything of value from anybody. You don't want to actually buy anything on payments. You know, there's girlfriends, there's things you just can't do. And not that I was ready for a girlfriend or a TV on payments or any of that stuff anyway, but it was just one more time, why me? Why can't I have this stuff? You know, I got pulled over and you drive real careful too. You learn how to drive cars when you're wanted. And just like a drunk learns, that light's going to turn red, I'm going to stop, you know, 300 yards short of it, and I'm going to let it turn green so I can just shoot through, you know, because you don't want to get caught at the red light because you're on display. And, you know, and the cops know you're drunk and they'll recognize who you are. And so it was another hard-fought battle, and the police pulled me over, and I told them I was Richard Nixon, and they didn't believe me. And they said, well, you seem like you fit the description of Wayne Grubbs. I go, I've been told that before, and it was straightened out, you know. Anyway, they cuffed me up. And I can remember my sponsor coming down, the old hand on the glass thing, like in the movies, you know. I'm like, oh, man, you know. see ya. And so I went to three or four county jails, got the sentence, went to, as God have it, I went to three county jails and two prisons. I was back in Sacramento Group 1 6 months later. And it was just like, you know, hey, man, maybe I didn't have to have the just say no hat. Maybe God's running this thing, you know, because it was unbelievable. And I was on a bicycle, man. I was grateful. And I sat down and I was, when I did, after they reclassified me down to a level 2 yard, they have AA meetings in prison. And I went into one of the meetings. You know, and they're reading this stuff. They weren't, people in prison don't know recovery as well as we do, okay? Let me just tell you that right now. So I was fresh from the streets. I was like the expert on recovery. And I tried to hide that for as long as I could. Because, you know, humility, you know, you got to have it. And so I don't know if I, like, shoved the dude out of the way and started reading how it works or whatever. But I started telling these people, they're talking about, oh, I've lost my life, I've lost my car. You know, I'm in prison. I've bottomed out. And I just told him, no, you haven't bottomed out. This is not a bottom. This is a resting stop on the way to your bottom. You know, you can rest here. Jesus Christ, you get three hot meals and the cops are folding your clothes. You know, you don't have to worry about paying your electricity bill. You can't pay it. Don't worry. Your wife's gone. You don't have any problems. That's the one thing they do. We need problems. So they lock you away from your problems. Yeah. Yeah. So I told them that I was walking the streets of Oakland barefoot until my feet were bleeding, so drunk I was half clothed. A police officer pulled up and said, do you have any identification? I said, I don't think I do. And they said, well, we don't even care anyway. And just pulled off. You know, I mean, and I could have died any moment. That was that was in Oakland, California. It was a rough spot to be walking around barefoot homeless and builds character though. And I look at that as like when it says in the big book, no matter how far down the chain we've gone, we can find our experience can help other people to recover from alcoholism. And you know, like sometimes the denial, sometimes the manufactured reasons that we have and the way that we manipulate our surroundings are so much a play in how we drink, and why we won't recover. You know, some people recover quick, man. I mean, I don't know how that happens. They get a 502, and they go into the starting point, and they've got 25 years now. You know, and some people are still out there. What's scary is the people that have 10, 15 years that are out there. And I know some of those cases. You know, so I learned that AA was a very, very loving place. Because no other place did I feel loved besides like AA. And I've got an opportunity to go places that no one knew me. And I felt love. That's a weird feeling for me to feel love. I mean, I needed to get negative attention. I mean, if I went out and threw a crowbar through your car, you ran over to me, it wasn't because you loved me. You know, it was because, you know, that was the negative part that I attracted people. And so, like, in recovery, I started doing the steps. I was an alcoholic addict, I think, or something. I forget what I was. And my sponsor quickly pointed it out to me. And a couple of the good old boys, the old timers, you know, friends of Ray's, told me, you can't be an alcoholic, you can't be a dope fiend here. You know, you need to be just an alcoholic. That's it. And if you ain't willing to do that, we ain't willing to help you. And I said, well, shoot, man, well, there goes all the love. You know, you're not going to love me back to life, Holmes, you know. So I dropped that, you know, and I, that's part of my story is that, like, I never really had any very contented self-worth or sobriety until I became an alcoholic. I just recently went to a meeting in Hawaii and I sat down in this Alano club and I had learned this in my heart. This is Wayne's truth. You know, I sat down in this room and there was somebody who had 15 years who was a dope fiend. The next person was a alcoholic pill taker and there was an alcoholic addict. And then the one person kind of looked over, all alcoholic addicts already taken, so they were an addict alcoholic, you know. And it's like, you know, everybody had to be different. It was a big room of different people, and that's not what AA is. AA is unity. You know, and part of our biggest strength, I believe, in my opinion, is the diversity we have in which we hold hands and pray. You know, and you can put a Hell's Angel, president of the Hell's Angels, next to a little old PTA president, and somehow they have the same feelings of despair, and somehow they drank for the same reasons and recovered with the same book. It causes a bond that's different than any paid-for membership that you can find anywhere in the world. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous is free, you know, and we give it away. That's why we're here, is to give back. So a lot of people don't quite have that giving back thing down yet, you know, but we don't frown at that because, like, you know, we're alcoholics. Alcoholics drink. They drink and they take, you know, I mean, and the highest I believe that is that you can get here in AA is sober. You know, don't look for something in AA here. You know, like, no one tells you that after you do your second 10th step, we're going to give you $100,000 to buy a house up on the hill. You know, that doesn't happen. But I'll tell you, the footwork that you do to get that sobriety will help you in most all areas of life, and that's my story. You know, when I first got sober, I went to rent an apartment. I'll tell you what, when I first got sober, I had never put together enough work. You know, how many people here work, you know? You guys work? All right. I never did. And I never put together enough to get a paid vacation. And I didn't spend my life in college either. You know, from 18 on, I never worked anywhere long enough to get a paid vacation until I got to this program. I have no 401k. I didn't have a driver's license, car insurance. I didn't have any, you know. When I got here, I had one pair of Levi's, and it was on the end of a stick that a nurse had going towards the trash can. And, you know, that's when I drove up. You know, and you know what happened? These other people had wives bringing them in, bathrobes and stuff. They'd bring me, hey, I got an extra pair of pants. You need a pair? I'll get you a pair of pants. I got a robe. My wife can bring in some shirts. Decked out. I'm ready for the meeting now. You know, get dressed up. We'd all go to the meeting, you know, and I was somebody. I was one of you guys. You know, I wasn't one of you guys. I want to be one of you guys. I want to always be one of you guys. I don't ever want to draw a line between me and you. You know, I don't want to be like, you know, any kind of special interest group, like, you know, I belong to a certain group of people that do a certain kind of service, and that's because we're a certain kind of people and you're not. You know, no, I want to be an alcoholic. I want to be an alcoholic. My whole life I wanted to be an alcoholic, and I finally made it, you know. I've been given the power to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety, and there is no other gift that you can be handed, monetary, spiritually, emotionally, that is more rewarding than that. You know, I mean, and to continue on life's terms and to live life the way you're supposed to live life. See, I'm a great believer in being able to absorb and feel life. Life is not all good. If it was, there'd be a problem. I think there would be some major problems. God would have to change all the rules so that there's a balance. There's, like, you know, my mom passed away in sobriety. My dad passed away. He drank himself to death up in the hills, Pinyon Pines. Lived in a little tiny trailer, man, with a car generator nailed down to a board with a lawnmower motor that turned the thing. That was his power, you know. And he was on a little Social Security check, but I'll tell you what, there's a little tiny bar up in Pinyon Pines, and they knew my dad. And he'd come in there, he had his checkbook wrote out, Professor Grubbs. I don't think he ever even went to college. And he, you know, Professor Haskell Grubbs, PhD in basic sciences or something, and he'd be writing checks for $2 to buy people beers. You know, he was that big time Charlie. The guy, you know, and in his head he was that way all the way to the end. You know, and so, like, and you know, whoops, my four steps is I'm a big time Charlie, you know, and you know, like, what a coincidence, you know, and how my dad related to me as a child. Now I have a 5-year-old. Part of my recovery, part of my sobriety, AA has brought to me a life that should have started right around 21 years old. But it happened at about 40, and I remarried, and I bought a house, and I bought a little apartment building. Incidentally, this part of my story is when I went to get an apartment, they told me I didn't have any credit at all. I couldn't get an apartment, and I bought on the same street I bought an apartment building, and I rent to people now. So I'm the guy that says, you know, okay, you can come on in and stay here, you know. But I have a wife. I have a 5-year-old daughter. And, you know, like my dad's job was to work real hard working guy, you know, 12 hours a day, you know. And then my mom would be the one that, like, validated his non-existence by, yeah, well, you got the best bicycle on the block, and your parents are, like, love you more than the other kids' parents do. And you know, your dad worked so hard to put this roof over your head because we could live in a littler neighborhood, and, you know, shouldn't you be happy? Oh, well, no, I want my dad, you know. And so now I come home, I work very hard, and I come home, I sit on the couch, and something inside says, your job's done. I've done what my dad did. You know, that's what I learned. That's how I learned it. My dad didn't actually teach me how to do this. It just happens. It's like in a biblical court. You know, it's like invisible parents on your shoulder telling you, this is how you're going to behave. And I had to fight that stuff back with 4 steps and 5 steps and people in this program that came from other normal, sometimes not so normal families. You know, I mean, only in this program when I started listening to other people's 5 steps did I figure out that some of the stuff I did was pretty darn bizarre. You know, and I really appreciate the chance to do that, to sponsor people, hear 5 steps. That's the music. That's the part of the excitement that's here. You know, Chuck Chamberlain used to say that if you could like just see the excitement, if the excitement in sobriety was to be a light, it would be so bright that you couldn't see it. It would just blind you, you know. And that excitement's here, and you have to tap into that excitement. Don't be one of the people that sits on the outside and said, yeah, my 4-step was boring. I could have probably went deeper, but, you know, there's no one that's not going to win. Our fellowship is made up of individuals and members like us. Our fellowship and the health of our fellowship and the safeguards of our future fellowship all depends on what kind of program we hand down to our sponsorees, you know, and it needs to be clean. You know, anytime you tell one alcoholic something and he tells the other alcoholic something and he tells somebody else's sponsor something different, it's so hard to keep the message clean in AA, you know. We want to find a way to live where we don't have to drink. It's a character defect. Drinking is a character defect. It's not an addiction. It's not a drug. It's not some weird thing. It's a character defect. We did not, for me, I did not want to feel life, so I drank because it produced not feeling. All right, well, now I want to feel. I mean, my whole life I knew what fun was. You get a limousine, a couple women, half gallon of rum, you know, half ounce of Coke, whatever, and I could have fun. I knew how to have fun. Somebody talk about, are you happy? I don't know. You know? And, you know, like, if I had to write my own dictionary, what is happiness? Is that like a whole bunch of funses in a row? It's not, because you run out. I see happiness in people's faces. You know what? Somebody saw it in mine. You know, I was in a store, just like the lights were on in my eyes, all together live, man. And they said, you're too happy. And I go, right on, man. No, I'm not. You know, no, I'm not too happy. You know, and we go into the institutions and we do the footwork we're supposed to do. You know, and we participate in our own recovery. Mike is probably one of the best examples that I know of a guy that has been in service. You know, I've done a little bit of work here and there, and he was a GSR for my group, and I don't think we've ever had the best GSR that Mike was ever. He went to every one of the area assemblies, went to every one of the district meetings, went to every one of our business meetings. He participates in his own recovery. You know, that's very, very important that we get in here and we do what we're supposed to do. Business meetings really aren't business meetings. in my opinion, they're a way of conducting the future of your group. You know, as our second tradition calls for a group conscience, we talk about stuff in a loving way, and we try and pull out God's will. That's all. God's will doesn't want you throwing ashtrays across the room at somebody that opposes your view. That's for the bar. And if people come here and see old-timers throwing ashtrays at each other, they're going to think that's AA. So sometimes your message is not only, it's like, please do what I don't do. Do what I say and not as I do. You know, and that's not what we want. We want love and service. Bob summed it up. He's a real good, complicated guy with a real simple program. He says, Bill, the steps boil down to love and service. We know what love is, and we know what service is. If you keep both those things in mind, with equal proportion, you'll do great. You know, somebody needs to man the tiller. Somebody needs to help steer AA in the future. There's probably lots of people here that are going to evolve into that type of service. And what you need to do is set good examples of service in your meetings and to your sponsorees. You know, and you got to learn that the same way you learned how not to drink. You know, you need to learn and work the steps. It's not service with recovery and unity. Our triangle has got recovery. That's the basis for everything. When you recovered and you have the ability to not character assassinate, slander, and manipulate, you know, to be dishonest and to pressure people into doing whatever you don't want to do, when you have that ability, then you can start serving AA. Until then, you might be hurting AA. So, you know, it's a real challenge to help secure AA. I have a 5-year-old daughter. There's a real good chance she's going to drink. I'll try. You know, I'm working the steps now. I'm trying to erase as much as I can of the family pattern that I received. I'm trying to do that with my 4-step and 5th-step. But there's a chance I can't get it all. She might drink. And if she does, I want AA here. I want it clean. And I want love and service here. You know, and so my message to people is be very, very, very careful on how you act in AA. You know, it's very valuable and very important not only to you, but to the fellowship in which you live in and live by. We have a responsibility to our fellowship just like we have a responsibility to our own recoveries, because collectively the fellowship is our own recoveries. You know, there's an old saying, and I'll probably get out of this thing with this old saying, and it's got a lot to do with the bickering and stuff that people do at business meetings, and it's like there's no one AA that has a torch bright enough to lead us all from drunken delusionment into the light of God. But each one of us in AA, as we get sober, have like a lit candle. And when we start bickering amongst ourselves and hurting and decaying the unity, we're blowing at each other's candles. And when we do that, we cup from the wind. And when we do, we start stealing the light from the path which saves us. Thank you very much.